You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Joel and I'm your host for today, covering for Caden, and I'll be with you for the next hour. Efai Akane coming up on the show. For International Desk, I speak to the Executive Director of the Britain-Palestine Project, Dr. Brian Rivati, about the potential shift in international order, looking at Israel's and the US's recent attacks on Iran and Israel's continued war on Gaza. Sarah, what do you have for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cevallone about the censorship of youth MPs in Parliament this week, as well as some of the financial changes that came into effect on July 1st. For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about the government's idea to scrap regional councils, as well as their request for the approval of up to 15-storey buildings around CRL stations. Finally, I spoke with Chair for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, about the disestablishment of Te Pū Kotahitanga.
He aho whakaaro. We would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or Waiamai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e a hei ana koto te whakarongo ki e nei, kōrero anō hei pakihiri roki roki mā runga I te pai tukutuku o Iramangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
As the Youth Parliament is set to take place this week, a number of youth MPs have spoken out, claiming they have been asked to change or remove elements of their speeches which criticise certain political figures or current topics like environmental action, pay equity and the Treaty Principles Bill. Youth organisation Gen Z Aotearoa founder Nate Wilborn was asked to edit parts of his speech, calling out Ministers Shane Jones, Tama Pōtaka and Penny Simmons on their role in environmental destruction. He said, "When your voices are edited to remove criticism, when ministers are shielded from being named, when we're told that our lived experiences are too political, that is not neutrality, that is protection of the status quo." As well, this week, on July 1st, a number of changes came into effect, including the government's KiwiSaver contributions and eligibility, the rate in payments for sole parents and through ACC, healthy home standards, and procedures for receiving the job seeker benefit. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked Deputy Leader Carmel Cevallone about both of these topics. Here is that interview. This week in the Youth Parliament, there have been claims that the youth MPs are being censored in what they can say and have been told to soften their language, to drop key parts of their speech, and to avoid criticising certain ministers or policies. How do you respond to these accusations?
Oh, this is hugely embarrassing for the government. We haven't seen this before during the time that we've had, that I've been in, certainly with Youth Parliament, where they try to censor the youth MPs and tell them what they can or can't say. I think that they're just scared of criticism, and I think that they realise it's probably not just the youth MPs in opposition parties that disagree with some of what they've done, but even their own youth MPs, I think, have the potential to be quite critical of the government's policies.
Do you think it's fair or at all useful for the youth parliament to be diluted to be more politically neutral or maintain the status quo?
No, not at all. In fact, I think it was silly that they said something along the lines of wanting to take the politics out of it. I mean, these young people have signed up to be youth MPs because they want to have a voice in politics. So we shouldn't have a government that are then diluting their ability to be able to share their views of the world. Right now, we probably need their views on what's happening in the world, to be honest. And I think that we should give the rangatahi some space to talk and take the time to listen.
In addition to the stipulation of changes for certain topics and speeches, how do you think the shift of approach to no longer live streaming the event reflects the government's commitment to platforming young people's political opinions?
Well, it shows they don't have a commitment to platforming young people's political opinion. And again, I think it's just fear of criticism. You know, we've got members of parliament in this coalition government who talk about the freedom of speech and people's rights to be able to say what they believe in. And yet we have a government here who are trying to hide those views from the rest of New Zealand because, quite frankly, they're scared that they'll be out of sync with what the coalition political parties think.
Do you think enough is being done generally in New Zealand to foster positive political engagement with young people?
No, I don't. And it's been an enduring problem. We don't have the level of civics education in schools that we need. We don't have the opportunities and spaces where we can very genuinely listen to the voices of rangatahi and take on board their ideas. And so I think there's much more that can be done in this space.
Given the urgency and relevance of issues being brought up in this youth parliament, like climate change, pay equity issues and the Treaty Principles Bill, as well as the clear capacity and willingness these young people have to engage with such topics, are you in favour of the voting age being lowered to 16?
I personally have always been in favour. I feel like it's an age group that is really engaged and really curious and wanting to understand how the world works and how politics impacts them. And so I don't know why, you know, we would shut them out. Personally, I think 16-year-olds should have the opportunity to vote, and I would hope then that would have an impact on their future voting records, because we know that if people vote in their first election, they'll continue to vote throughout their life.
Moving on to my next topic, we've got changes to KiwiSaver contributions this week, to a number of benefits, to different payments, as well as the healthy home standards. Are there any changes that have been implemented this week that you're particularly against or, on the other hand, particularly happy with?
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, we can touch on a couple. One is the changes to superannuation, with the government cutting their contribution, cutting it in half for many New Zealanders and cutting it completely to those that earn over 180,000. You know, on one hand, they're saying that we need to take saving seriously and that they want to encourage New Zealanders to save for their retirement. And then on the other hand, they're cutting their own contribution. It seems to be a little bit of a contradiction and not fair on New Zealanders that are paying into the scheme. The government should show that they are committed to the scheme by continuing it, but instead they're cutting the contribution that they make. I think the family boost policy has clearly been a huge embarrassment to the government. Nicola Willis keeps trying to blame the government officials, particularly IRD, but they developed this policy whilst in opposition, and it has not served the thousands of New Zealanders that they said that it would serve, and now they're having to try and tweak it to get the money out the door. It's just embarrassing and not helpful when so many New Zealanders are struggling with the cost of living right now.
What would you say you recommend in terms of altering these kinds of issues to address the cost of living for these groups?
Well, firstly, get it right. You know, we've developed policies in opposition before, and we developed them properly, and we developed them knowing what the implementation would look like, and then we were able to do that when we got it. The families package that we introduced in 2017 when we became our government is a good example of that. Those were developed in opposition and we were able to do them. Right now, people do need reprieve. And, you know, let's reflect on what has been cut. They've lost access to the free public transport for children, half price for young people. People have lost access to the free prescriptions so that when they're sick, they can get access to those. We've lost thousands of jobs across the country, particularly in the construction industry, and particular areas in the country are feeling it more than others, especially Auckland. And so these are the types of things that are not helping with the cost of living challenges that people are facing. And if anything, they've exacerbated those challenges. And the government has to take responsibility for that.
Do you think it's beneficial to the welfare system that the government now requires 6 monthly reviews of job seekers?
No, it's not. And again, this is stuff that the government had information put in front of them on. And so they've been given the advice and they push ahead anyway. What it means is that you have a greater level of compliance in the system, which is much more stressful for those who are struggling to find work and having to rely on support from the state in terms of welfare payments. Keeping in mind, again, I just said, the job market is terrible at the moment, so it's not these people's fault. But also the advice that the government was given was that because of the capacity issues within the Ministry for Social Development, if they keep pushing up the compliance activities, like this, 6 monthly reviews, then it will take away the staff's ability to actually provide meaningful support to get into work to our people that are on benefit. And the choice they have made is compliance. And so our frontline staff will be tied up with 6 month reviews and sanctions and all of the punitive stuff, and won't actually have the time to support people to get into the employment opportunities that may still be there. And to me, that just seems counterproductive.
Finally, what are your thoughts overall with regard to how these changes respond to the highest priority needs of New Zealanders?
Oh, my thoughts are that they fail. The government on the 1st of July has failed New Zealanders. They've broken promises and they have under-delivered. They came into government during that election campaign saying that they were going to provide relief to New Zealand families who are struggling with the cost of living, and thousands of New Zealand families are not feeling that relief. Many are struggling with the basics, including buying that pound of butter at the supermarket and putting the roof over their head each week. So this government has failed, and I would be giving them a thumbs down for their efforts.
That was Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone on the Youth MPs in Parliament, as well as KiwiSaver, JobSeeker Benefits and other financial changes which came into effect this week.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Regional Development Minister Shane Jones has suggested to the Local Government Forum that regional councils may be abolished, stating that after the upcoming changes to the Resource Management Act, he doubts that there is going to be a compelling case for regional government to continue to exist. Regional councils across Aotearoa are responsible for matters relating to natural resource management, flood control and biosecurity. Prime Minister Christopher Luxton said effectiveness between different councils is varied and that councils generate too much bureaucracy and are too focused on vanity projects. As well, in order to make the most of local and central investment into Auckland's growing city, the government is asking Auckland Council to increase the housing development allowance around key central rail link stations in the lead up to the project's completion. Seeking to amend the Resource Management Act, the government hopes to increase housing height and density around Mount Albert and Baldwin Avenue stations, allowing upzoning of 10 stories around these areas, in addition to allowing upzoning of 15 stories around Mungo, Morningside and Kingsland. I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about both of these topics, starting with the proposal to scrap regional councils. Do you think that Jones's assertion about the redundancy of regional councils paints an accurate picture?
I worry that central government doesn't really understand local government and regional government quite a lot. And I suspect this is a really good example, unfortunately, where regional government is generally included as part of local government. We just talk about central and local government, that regional is included with local, right? And in Auckland, we have a unitary council. We don't have a separate regional council. But in practice, the role I do is regional. I'm empowered and elected. My mandate is to think regionally, even though I'm elected by a local ward. That said, in parts of New Zealand where they do have separate regional council, the bulk of the work that they do is in the environmental protection space. And I think that Minister Jones, who has a history for not being particularly interested in environmental regulation, I think that's really what he's getting at, is that he wants to see less environmental regulation, and regional councils are the ones in other parts of the country that primarily are focused on that. And so if you get rid of the regulator, you get rid of the regulations. I think that's probably really where he's coming from, and I think that shows a real lack of understanding of the importance of of environmental regulation. So that's a really big worry, actually, because I think it's not about getting rid of regional councils and necessarily making sure their functions are done in other places. I think actually his motivation is probably more about making sure we don't do their work at all, which is absolutely vital and needs to be democratically, have that democratic oversight of people elected to do that work.
Do you think there's any way that the system of councils across Aotearoa could be improved in terms of efficiency and simplicity?
I think we've learnt from the super city that there can be. I was a real sceptic about the super city. But I think we've learned that there can be some real benefits to working properly regionally, and we didn't really have the grunt we needed under the previous structure, which is the structure that applies in most of New Zealand now, to really solve particularly the transport issues. I think while we still have a lot of transport issues, I think having a really strong regional focus, albeit with some democratic deficiencies in the model because Auckland Transport's a CCO, I think we've been able to make a lot more progress in the transport space than we did previously. And I think that Wellington in particular have sort of been putting their hands up going, hey, we can see some benefits here for in the transport space for some level of amalgamation. So I'm not saying there's no benefit from amalgamation, but what you absolutely have to keep front and centre is that, you know, principle of localism, the principle of subsidiarity, as it's referred to in local government land, which is that decisions should be made at the lowest level possible. And I think that's where local boards for Auckland, which is a unique structure, giving them more power, more resources than community boards had, putting them more on the level of, say, a district council, has been a really important part of keeping localism alive. Sometimes it's just sort of clinging in there, but by and large, the structure allows for that. So that would be my one thing of caution about amalgamation, is that local areas need to have strong local decision-making structures that can reflect and deliver for their communities, and any structure needs to ensure that. So, you might lose some economic efficiency in the short-term sense, but you will gain more trust and confidence in the local system of governance, which itself has bigger long-term economic benefits, better decision-making, less of people breaking the rules because they don't see them as having had a mandate or being legit. So, the idea of short-term efficiencies versus long-term gains, I think sometimes we focus on what's the rates rise next year when actually we should be looking at the bigger picture of actually how do we make better long-term decisions, and amalgamation can go either way on that.
You mentioned before that regional councils are responsible for management of, like, environmental management and natural resources and that kind of thing. Could you talk a bit more about how this proposal, if it were to go ahead, would impact those services or those decision-making processes, or maybe shift how that would look in New Zealand?
We don't really know yet as part of the problem. It's sort of being kicked around, and obviously Minister Jones is in New Zealand First, and the Minister for Local Government is actually a National Party minister. We don't know what ACT would think. It's all tied up with the Resource Management Act reforms as well, which is largely being overseen by a different government minister, Minister Bishop. So I think it's probably too soon to say what any proposals might do. My experience in Auckland is that in the first couple of terms, a lot of the work that had previously been done by the regional council, the Auckland Regional Council, actually fell through the cracks. And so quite a lot of the sort of environmental regulation stuff sort of got put to one side and dealt with sort of bureaucratically within the organisation, but actually didn't have the level of democratic oversight that it needed. And so, for example, a lot of the pest management work sort of ended up, rather than sitting with individual local boards who managed areas that had pest problems, you know, maybe they had a regional park in the area. It sort of sat more with the staff and didn't have a lot of bureaucratic oversight. And then we sort of had a period where we kind of, the staff did their best, but there wasn't that political buy-in, there wasn't that political vision. And it took a couple of terms before we sort of got back into that, and we lost quite a lot of momentum. And so that's the real risk, I think, of if you play around with that model without clearly saying, okay, this is where that function goes, this is where these decisions now move to, and they move immediately and they have resources, and here's the structure, and here's how the public have a say in that, here's the consultation processes and things like that, then actually you lose that work and you lose some momentum. And with a lot of environmental regulation, losing focus means you go backwards, and then you have to make up that ground. It makes it even harder to protect our water, to protect our air, to protect our natural environment as well. So it's really critical to get that transition right.
I wanted to talk about another topic as well. Housing Minister Chris Bishop and Auckland Minister Simeon Brown said this week that they want to allow even greater housing and development around CRL stations, quote unquote, ensuring that Auckland takes economic advantage of this transformational investment in the city. Does the government's ambition for the increased housing intensification cohere with the council's existing vision and discussion around planning for growth relating to the City Rail Link in Auckland?
So Auckland Council has a general sort of policy that's mostly in line with what's called a compact city model. It's not entirely in line with that. We still allow for building out on the outskirts, but by and large we are heading in a direction of encouraging more housing to be closer to the city centre, where there's work and education and services and things. Closer to, and when I say closer, I mean, you know, within 20 kilometres. I don't mean right all in the city centre. And this proposal is in line with that, that we increase the amount of housing supply and the different types of housing that you can get as well, that is close to the city centre, that is close to major town centres, that is close to rapid transit networks, so yeah, the rail lines obviously, and you know, major arterial routes like, say, Dominion Road, Sandringham Road, Mount Eden Road, Great South Road, Great North Road, New North Road, all of those, right? A lot of which run through that area that I represent. So that has huge benefits, partly because we know there's a whole lot of economics around the benefits of cities and what's called agglomeration, having people and services and workplaces and all that kind of stuff close together. But also it massively has an impact on carbon emissions. So having people not having to travel as far, being able to live in ways where they don't have to own a private car to be able to participate, they can use public or active transport modes. All of those things reduce carbon emissions, which is the number one thing we can do as a city, is to make that transport shift to reducing our carbon emissions in terms of climate action. For me, going up around those major transport, those major stations in the inner west is a no-brainer. We should also, though, be looking to go up around the train stations in the inner east as well. And so I'm looking forward to the conversation about Orake and Meadowbank at Remuera stations as well. And we also, with those, you know, Kingsland, Morningside, Mount Albert, Mount Eden, among those stations, we also need to think about how do we find a balance there, because there's some specific character in those neighbourhoods, and I think people want to live there, right? Which means, you know, more housing there will be something people want so that they can live there. But also, how do we help those town centres to maintain their, you know, their local character and grow and create sort of the heritage of the future, as well as looking to, you know, honour the past. There's going to be a balance that needs to be met.
Has anyone raised, or are there any potential challenges or concerns you foresee for these areas, especially coming from the public as a result of this upscaling of building heights?
I've had a mixture, really. So I have had a couple of emails from people, including a local residents association, expressing concern, and what they're looking for is that, you know, how do we maintain existing character? But I've also seen on Facebook, I'm in all the local Facebook community groups, there's over 30 of them. I can't keep an eye on all of them closely, but I have seen a lot of people posting about this stuff, about, you know, going up to 15 stories around these train stations. And a lot of the comments have actually been really supportive. So I think it's going to be a really interesting public conversation to have. The reality is that if central government tells council we have to do this, we have to do this. So there's not necessarily going to be a lot of nuance to it. But what I'm really interested in is how we can, as a council, help locals to be involved in, okay, how do we come up with a local plan for that area that balances those different needs, that allows for the future growth, that makes sure we have the libraries and the open spaces and the retail areas and the hospitality, as well as the housing, that all makes a really cool, vibrant neighbourhood. I was really lucky to be involved in a project like that in Three Kings when I was on the local board. And the housing is starting to be sold in that area in Three Kings. But I've also had some involvement with some Kāinga Ora redevelopments, and where they've done major neighbourhood redevelopments, some of which are unfortunately now indefinitely paused, where again the community involvement and saying, hey, we know growth and change is coming, we know that it needs to happen, we know that we need more housing in our community. How do we as a community have a say in where that is, what that looks like, and making sure that the people who are going to live here, who become part of our neighbourhood, have access to open space, have good public transport links, can walk through our community so we don't have gates and we're not split off from each other. So that for me is the real opportunity I see for local government. If central government's going to tell us you've got to do this anyway, then our role is going to be, okay, how do we do this best? And I'm looking forward to that.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry on the future of regional councils, as well as aims for further housing intensification around CRL stations.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text in 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces.
I believe in, like, the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday. Hello, my little sparrows. If you're listening right now, then this message was meant for you. Claim it if it resonates. I've got my tarot deck here. I'm going to pull a card to illuminate an intention for you. Just shuffling. Ooh, it's the B card. This card represents prosperity, greatness, clout. Oh, I love this for you. Expect an abundance of free things. Music, merch, coffee, ticket.
Get a B card today from 95bfm.com for just $4.20 a month and be in to win tickets, albums and more.
If music is the food of love, then we hope you're hungry, because you've got a ticket to the buffet.
Love language.
If music is the fuel of love, then vroom vroom, baby, it's time to hop on board.
Love language.
And if music is the language of love, then you better tune in to Love Language to stay literate.
Love language.
Spend some quality time with your Love Language hosts, Carlotta and Scarlett. 9 to 11pm on the last three Saturdays of every month. Right here on 95 BFM.
Yeah. fight or flight. Feel the exact swelling at the petty slight. The octopus can't survive with one tentacle lost per night. Initiate a fight or flight. Feel the ink sac swelling at the petty slide. The octopus can survive with one tentacle lost per night. Swelling at the petty slide. The octopus can survive with one tentacle lost per night. I chopped off all eight in fright, and now I'm going to fucking die.
Was Colio Idea by Lee. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Art, go.
Following Israel and the US's large-scale attacks on Iran and Israel's continued war on Gaza, this has raised the question of the future of international order. Last night, I spoke to the executive director of the Britain-Palestine Project, Dr. Brian Bravati, about this turning point in international order and what we should expect heading forward. What implications are there for how people worldwide will view the UN, ICC and ICJ with how Israel was able to attack Iran and Israel's continued assault on Gaza?
So I think they indicate we are at an inflection point in the world international system. But let's be clear, the ICC, the ICJ, the UN have tried to do everything they can within the letter of international law to hold Israel to account. There's been no shortage of cases. There's the South African genocide case. There's the ICJ's advisory on Israeli practices in occupied territories. There have been condemnations by the General Assembly. But while the UN Security Council allows permanent members to have a veto, there's a limit to what you can further push Israel to do through international law. And this is where the system, you know, it's been coming apart for a long time, but it really is coming apart now. Russia can attack Ukraine with impunity. Israel can attack Gaza with impunity, and now Iran with impunity, and Yemen and Lebanon and Syria over the last 18 months. So we need to have a rethink if international law is going to function at all.
Despite the ceasefire not holding, Israel did cease their military campaign on Gaza at the start of this year, largely due to the US. What does this say about how Israel views the US compared to the aforementioned international institutions?
Well, that's the key, isn't it? It was US real political, economic power that allowed a pause to take place. Nothing that the UN had done or the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, had done had any impact on Israeli political or strategic decision-making. Today, Trump has said that Israel is close to agreeing a 60-day ceasefire in Gaza. Israel can accept that because they know that Hamas is unlikely to now accept it anymore, because they know the ceasefire will now be broken, and because it's largely part of Israeli politics. Israel is preparing for a general election to be called, and Netanyahu is maneuvering to try and get as many victories on his belt as he possibly can ahead of an election. All of that internal political machinations and all of that real power relationship with the US matters infinitely more now in the calculations that states make than international law does.
Are countries like the US and Israel undermining these international institutions? And if so, why?
Well, I think that they are undermining them because they do not believe any international organization should have the ability to constrain the freedom of their decision making. The only way multilateral institutions work is if you pool some sovereignty and you allow those international organizations to have some ability to influence what you do, right? So that you can't just act however you like. If you don't accept that, then you don't accept the basis upon which international law and multilateral institutions function. So some people argue that's always been the case, that since 1945, states have always done what they like. But that isn't actually true. I think there have been periods in which states have felt constrained upon their actions, and I think there are periods in which states have acted with impunity. What we have now is routine impunity, case after case after case. And the reason is that they do not believe that any entity other than the state itself should make decisions about how the state acts, and no other entity should hold citizens of that state, particularly if they're in the military, accountable for their actions.
And what are we seeing from other global powers regarding how they are viewing these international bodies in light of Israel's war on Iran and Gaza?
So there's an irony here, isn't there, that you know, the post-1945 international institutions were created in Europe as a response to the Second World War, and the UN was created to ensure the world war would never happen again and move towards world government. And it was the Western powers that drew the rest of the world into this process. It's now a lot of Western powers, Russia, Israel, and the US being absolutely central to the creation of the UN, who are abandoning those processes. And it's the global South that's saying, well, hold on, we want to support international law. We take these institutions seriously. And in a sense, the center of gravity of international law now rests in the global South and in, you know, to be fair, in the European Union, which remains a great supporter of the rules-bound systems. So we're at a, that's why I say we're at an inflection point in terms of international law. Either these institutions change, so either we enlarge the Security Council, we bring on powers like India and Brazil onto the Security Council, we move to majority voting, we get rid of the veto, all these systems will decline and decline and decline. And don't forget also that the funding for them is also being driven down. So the US has massively reduced funding to the UN, which destroys its ability to do many things, including a massive cut in funding for peace building and mediation.
What does this mean for smaller countries who might be potentially impacted by larger powers undermining these international institutions?
It means that, you know, the global police force is absent without leave. And that exposes smaller countries, particularly resource-rich smaller countries, to exploitation. And, you know, it's not just the Russias and the Israels we're talking about. China, in its economic warfare, is also pursuing a series of policies of extraction, particularly of raw materials, which go against other forms of international control, like the World Trade Organization. So small countries in this situation are extremely vulnerable. And I think that the unless we can reconstruct some of these institutions, we're essentially moving into a siloed world where those countries who are at the edge of, say, Russian influence, US influence, European influence, will increasingly be the subject of intrastate and interstate wars. And we're seeing that, for example, in the South Caucasus at the moment, where Armenia is caught between Iran and Turkey and Russia. So I wouldn't want to be a small country in a number of these neighborhoods right now. Better off being an island like New Zealand or the UK, frankly.
In light of Israel's continued war on Gaza and attacks on Iran, will efforts to manage conflicts internationally change?
The problem, fundamentally, is the resources that are devoted to conflict management, peace building, have been decimated in the cuts that have taken place in the US. The UK has made cuts in this area. The EU has stepped up to try and fill some of that gap, But essentially, the peace-building apparatus has been hollowed out. So we've got to find new ways. And that essentially means bottom-up peace-building. Peace processes that are going to work. So if we look at Israel, Palestine, Iran, it's really going to be a regionally led process where regional powers and those powers that are most affected directly by the conflict come up with a process themselves, rather than this sort of Western designed process from the UN and the international community of peace builders being imposed from above, because the resources for that imposition of external peace process are no longer there and they don't work. What works, or what can be seen to be work, is very slow, very grassroots built, very up from the bottom peace building, where states begin over sometimes decades to work together to see that peace is in their own self-interest, their mutual interest. And it's being worked on now. It hasn't quite emerged what these kind of new processes will be, but they'll look very different from a traditional peace-building process of smoke-filled rooms of a bunch of men sitting around negotiating away the future of other places, because we've found those systems only work where there's international law to then support a comprehensive peace agreement. And what we've seen is international law no longer has the power to deliver on those kind of agreements and treaties.
What does all of this say about the future of the post-1945 international order?
That we've got to rebuild it, that it is broken and not working, despite, you know, the good will of a lot of the people who work within the UN system. They cannot deliver if fundamentally states do not want to be held to account. So we need to rebuild it. I mean, something better needs to emerge from the quagmire. And I don't think it's going to emerge until we're in a post-Trump, post-Netanyahu, post-Putin political world. Then we might stand a chance. My great fear is that the 1945 system was based on year zero, you know, the absolute annihilation of Europe in the Second World War. We mustn't allow the world to get to a point where the only way we can construct a new rules-based system is on the ashes of mass destruction and mass war. My fear is that that's the way we're heading, and that the human beings seem only capable of reconstructing things that are better once they've really destroyed everything that was there before. Let's hope that there is a way of triangulating without ultimate destruction to a new system. But I can't pretend to be particularly optimistic at the moment. We shouldn't simply attack the UN and the people who work in the UN for their failure. It's very important, I think, to remember it's not their failure. The UN hasn't failed. The ICC, the ICJ have not failed to hold these states to account. They are not willing to be held to account. And if they don't opt in, international law is not like national law, right? And some people argue it's not law, really. It's just a way of building customary behaviors. But if you don't accept that, then they don't have any power to make you accept it. So it's not the fault of the systems, it's the fault of the states.
That was the Britain Palestine Project's Dr. Brian Abravati on the future of international order.
International Desk on 95BFM.
We'll be right back.
Thank you. Every time we speak, I don't want to hear the end of it. Months that follow, I'll be hanging on to words.
that was Sucking on a Surly Pout by Ringlets. Before that, you had You at the Top of the Driveway by Maple Glider. And before that, we had See, Swallow Me by the Cocteau Twins and Harold Budd.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
As Family Violence Service Provider Shine amps up their July Light It Orange campaign, the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children have released a statement condemning the decision by Minister for Children and for the Prevention of Family and Sexual Violence, Karen Chua, to disestablish Te Pū Kotahitanga. This collective is a Māori partnership body for the elimination of family violence and sexual violence, which gives Māori leaders a critical voice at the decision-making table. In their statement, they said the decision is disrespectful to both Māori and non-Māori and furthers the systematic erosion of tiriti-based governance, entrenching distrust of the Crown across all communities. Following a report released earlier this week by the National Mortality Review Committee, which found that Māori women are disproportionately impacted by family and sexual violence, experts in this field have stressed the need for a stronger, multi-agency response that is effective, proactive, and includes crisis support. There have also been calls for a national conversation that treats gender-based violence as a public, not private issue, and highlights the issue of femicide in Aotearoa. To discuss this topic further, I spoke with Chair of the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, about what the disestablishment of Te Pū Kotahitanga means for mahi and outcomes relating to Māori. Here is that interview. What has been Minister Karen Chua's justification regarding the decision to disestablish this collective?
Well, you'd need to talk to her about that. The report that the collective has been disestablished, it was initially set up under our National Family and Sexual Violence Plan, and it was designed to ensure accountability, shared leadership and cultural integrity in the family and sexual violence response.
What will be some of the direct and indirect impacts as a result of the loss of this group, which provides accountability, leadership and cultural integrity under Te Aorerekura?
Well, it's incredibly disrespectful to Māori, to Te Pū Kotahitanga, to Te Tiriti. It's a huge step backward for us. We need more Māori leadership, not less, in our pathway towards ending family and sex violence in New Zealand.
How do you think this decision reflects the government's commitment to Māori-led kaupapa, as well as to the safety and well-being of families and children?
It shows complete disregard for both of those things. And it's extremely distressing to us. We stand with Te Pū Kotahitanga in demanding that they are reinstated. There's wahine Māori experience ongoing colonisation. For example, if a wahine Māori is seeking safety from a violent relationship, she has to consider the possibility of having a child off her if she does so. So many women, particularly Māori women, stay in violent relationships because they can't trust the state to help them. Māori communities can and have found successful ways to address this violence, and we need the state in those circumstances to get out of the way and let Māori provide Māori solutions to family violence.
In light of the most recent report from the National Mortality Review Committee, which identified inequities in the rates of family violence for kōtero and wahine Māori, what would be your recommendation to the government in terms of ensuring that governmental agencies comprehensively and effectively respond to the harms faced, particularly by these disproportionately affected groups?
Well, obviously, they need to follow the lead of Māori experts. They need to put a lot more money into the system. At the moment, money is being taken away from family violence. And obviously, if we're going to solve this problem, we need to fund violence prevention thoroughly.
Are there any other changes or actions you would like the government to take to support the work that groups within the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children do in Aotearoa?
Well, the Coalition for the Safety for Women and Children, our kaupapa is to always put the safety of the victim first. That's the number one thing. And also to hold the perpetrator accountable. If the government used that lens on a family and sexual violence, they would make a lot more progress than ignoring Māori and the piecemeal attempts that they're currently making.
Is there at all a role for the public to play to help uplift mahi in this sector?
Absolutely. It's great to magnify our message. If everybody stood up and supported the re-establishment of te kukutahitanga, that would be a step forward. And if people, wherever they are, always looked to support victims, not blame and shame victims, then this would be progress for all of us.
Do you have any final message or comments for Minister Chaw or for the government regarding this decision or regarding the future of family violence and sexual violence collectives or work in New Zealand?
We want the Crown to understand that what they've done disrespects Māori, it disrespects Te Tuariti, and it erodes trust in the Crown. So we need them to listen to Māori experts and to follow their lead.
That was Chair of the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, on the disestablishment of Te Pū Kotahitanga.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. Nē te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpiti Thursday. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Stefaloni, Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry, the Britain Palestine Project's Dr Brian Bravati, and Auckland Women's Centre Project Lead Leonie Morris. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia. Yeah.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.